When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com.
Farm Africa!
Oye!
Uganda!
Oye!
Kanungu!
Oye!
Youth!
Oye!
Women!
Oye!
Coffee!
Oye!
UK!
Oye!
What you've just heard is the reaction of farmers in Kanunga, Uganda, to hearing that Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal has launched. Between 8th of February and the 8th of May, donations in support of my London Marathon Challenge will go to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal. If you can donate before 8th of May 2019, all public donations to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal will be doubled by the UK government. What a country. Your donation will support Farm Africa projects across Eastern Africa, and the matched funding you unlock from the UK government will directly fund a Farm Africa project that will give women in Kanungu in Western Uganda the opportunity to make a decent living from coffee farming. I'm trying to raise £5,000 to support the appeal, and if you could spare anything at all, we would greatly appreciate it. Just visit justgiving.com/fundraising/William-Evans12, and I will put that link in the show notes. Thank you. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 110. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading up to North Northumberland to talk to a farmer and co-founder of Drone Ag, Jack Wrangham. Jack, how are you?
How you doing, Will?
Yeah, I'm very, very well. Not particularly enjoying this horrible return to winter we've had. High winds and sideways sleet, but other than that, I'm all good. Have you had that up there today as well?
Yeah. I've heard the term "fool's spring" coined a few times, and I think we're definitely back into winter for a bit. We've had a bit of sleet and all that kind of stuff as well. So
yeah,
it's not exactly been drone flying weather anyway.
Absolutely not. And I just before we go any further, congratulations on having such an excellent name, because Jack Wrangham sounds like a sort of hard hitting 1950s detective who's tired of all the crap he gets from those pen pushers up at City Hall.
I suppose I'm a bit like that anyway, but problem with detective anyway.
So tell us about Northumberland, Jack, where you live. What have you got going on up there?
So we've got a family farm up here. We farm about 6,000 acres up in the lovely hills of Northumberland. It's all one big enclosed farm, which is great. We've got around about 3,000 acres of arable, so cereals, oilseed rape. And then we have sheep, cattle as well, and quite a lot of moorland, which we don't really do much with, but there's plenty of space anyway.
Yeah, okay. And is that where you grew up? You grew up on that farm?
Yeah. So we grew up, me and my brother Hugh would be third generation.
Okay.
So it was my granddad that that moved into the place here and started farming it originally. My dad's still very much involved, and then my brother Hugh is starting to take over the general farm management side of things.
Yeah, okay. So do you live on the farm now?
Yeah, we do. Me and my family, we have one of the houses on the farm. I moved back about 5-6 years ago now. So yeah.
Growing up though, you obviously didn't want to go down the farming route, because when you left school you qualified as a ski instructor in New Zealand, which not necessarily the normal path for a farmer's son from Northumberland, I would have thought.
I certainly, I wouldn't say I wanted to get away because I didn't like it here, because I loved it around here, But I certainly had itchy feet and wanted to go and explore and do other things as well. And been lucky enough to ski from a very early age. I've had the bug throughout my entire life, really absolutely love it.
Yeah.
So as soon as I had the opportunity to go away and do that for a good few seasons, I kind of jumped on it.
Yeah. And I've been skiing in New Zealand. It's something else, isn't it, down in that South Island? Brilliant fun.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's very different to Europe and the US and that kind of stuff. The resorts were a lot smaller, but they were a lot more open as well. So there was certainly enough to do for a whole season.
Yeah.
It's also one of the cheapest places to go heli skiing in the world as well. So I was very lucky enough to do that.
Awesome. And in the States as well.
Yes. Yeah. And then I did two seasons teaching in the States as well, over in Colorado. The resort of Keystone is where I was based.
Brilliant.
And again, yeah, that was incredible. Very lucky to be over there, and obviously being there whole season means you get to see some pretty epic snow days and that kind of thing. So
I'll bet. Any bad injuries? Ever totally stacked it?
I made the mistake of getting very overconfident in the park one day. I don't really do rails and jumps and all that kind of stuff much. I'm not really that into it.
Yeah.
But we did an instructor day where we all, as instructors, went into the park and got taught how to do a few things. And towards the end of the day, I was obviously getting pretty confident. And I have a memory of skiing up to a very large metal rail and then waking up in hospital. and I still to this day don't remember anything on the in-between bit.
Oh, right.
But I managed to fracture my eye socket by landing face first on my pole. So I was in quite a lot of pain for a few weeks after that. That's the only thing so far, touch wood, that's happened. So I've been pretty lucky overall, really.
Definitely. Do you still get skiing much now, or get too busy?
Too busy, yeah. We are actually planning to go for the first time for a good few years at the end of this season. And I'm taking out my two stepdaughters that are 9 and 11.
Wow.
Actually, Ruby's 12 now. We're taking them out for the first time. Brilliant. So I'm quite looking forward to teaching them how to get into it.
I'll bet. Okay, so after you finished doing your skiing seasons, what happened next?
So, yeah, I came back to Northumberland. Pretty much looking... Well, I should say, actually, I had gone to university in between. Enjoyed myself far too much and not really done much work. The original plan was to come back for my ski seasons and go back to university.
Yeah.
But it didn't really happen that way, and I ended up getting a job working for a local company called HeliGuy, who sold at the time what were just off the shelf remote control toy helicopters, really.
Okay.
And I started doing quite a lot of graphic design and web design for them over the years. And eventually, me and one of the guys that worked there, we decided to set up our own business doing aerial photography with a big remote control helicopter with a camera basically strapped to the front of it.
Okay.
And that's when all this stuff kind of started, really, I would say.
Yeah. So, were you one of those kids who was always interested in that kind of stuff? Did you have like a remote control plane as a kid and that kind of thing? Or where did the interest come from?
I'd never really had like remote control planes and stuff like that. I would say I definitely had a few remote control cars.
Yeah.
But definitely a geeky kid. You know, I loved my Lego Technic, Meccano, all that kind of stuff. So I was always building and tinkering with things.
Yeah.
So getting a hold of a big boy's toy, which was I think we used a T-Rex 700, it was called, which was about £3,000 remote control helicopter that we had to build ourselves.
Yeah.
It was quite an exciting way to start looking at potentially making money through it as well.
Yeah.
Although we pretty quickly found that actually building your own helicopter makes it extremely unreliable for the most part and prone to crashing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I suppose, did you say 2012, you and your colleague established the business? Quite pioneering, though. Would have been.
I think it was 2010, actually.
Okay.
It'll have been 2010. I can't remember. There's a plaque on the wall outside the office, which we got when we first established it. And I think it's 2010.
Okay. So back in those days, there wouldn't have been many other people doing stuff like that, would there? It was quite pioneering.
No, not at all. There was a couple of other companies in the UK that had started doing it. And we were among them. I think if you look at the records from the CAA of when they granted what was called permissions for aerial work back then, so operating a drone, a helicopter commercially or whatever, I think now there's about 4,000, and ours was number 36.
So. Wow. Okay. So steep learning curve, I guess.
It was, yeah, yeah, definitely. That's one way to put it. you know, the technology back then was it was so nowhere near as advanced as it is today. You know, a drone, as we call it now, didn't exist back then. Mm-hmm. That idea of something that has, you know, four or more motors and flies very, very easily and very, very stably, that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. All the remote control helicopters back then, you had to be able to pilot them really, really well. So, you know, it took a pilot just to keep the thing in the air, let alone do what you wanted. So it was, it was definitely much more of a challenge.
Yeah. And you just had a camera, like a normal off-the-shelf camera strapped to it.
Yeah, yeah, we used a Canon 5D, Canon 5D Mark II, which was a good camera.
Yeah,
really good. But it was also, you know, big and heavy, so we had to have a pretty big helicopter to carry it as well.
Yeah,
okay. And the gimbal that the camera sat in was all mechanical. These days they're much more advanced.
Mm-hmm.
So video wasn't really possible because you just couldn't make it smooth enough.
Mm.
It would have been all over the place. But we could certainly get decent stills.
Yeah, okay. So tell us about the job you did for the BBC out in Kenya.
Yeah, so that was certainly part of the steep learning curve. We were very, very lucky in the early days. When we parted company from HeliGuy and set up Horizon Aerial Photography, our own business doing aerial photography with these helicopters, HeliGuy were very supportive. And they were passing a few jobs our way. So if people contacted them looking for that kind of service, then they put them onto us. And the BBC contacted HeliGuy looking for potentially some kind of remote control helicopter thing to go out and do some filming in Kenya for a natural history series they were doing. So we went out there to do that. It ended up being me going out with all the kit and as the pilot.
Yeah.
And yeah, got out there and it was great for a couple of days. Got everything set up. It was all working relatively well. And we started doing some filming. But quite quickly, the helicopter ran into an issue. I was flying it through some trees quite low, getting quite a low shot. And suddenly, for even to this day, we're not quite sure why, the helicopter started climbing and flying away really, really quickly, completely out. And I didn't have any control over it.
Okay.
It just shot off. So I ran off after it, thinking, swearing quite a lot, as you might imagine. And I just remember the rest of the crew shouting at me, "Jack, lions, there's lions." And I thought, oh, God. So I had, there's a pack of lions nearby. So I had to stop in the middle of the bush. And I ran back and we jumped in a vehicle and chased off this helicopter that had a mind of its own. And the helicopter had a... Even that back then, there was had a little bit of computing power, so there was a failsafe built in. Basically, meant it lost signal with me and my radio controller, the helicopter would stop. So I turned off the radio, and that triggered the failsafe, and the helicopter went into a hover, and it just sat there hovering, which was great. Okay, it stopped, so we caught up with it again in the vehicle, and just looking up, and you see this helicopter just sitting there hovering, and we're like, okay, how are we going to get it down? And so I thought, okay, well, I'm close to it now. So I turn the radio back on, and immediately the helicopter shoots off again.
Right.
And at this point, it's pretty high up, and it's flying really, really fast. And we actually had a bit of video footage after we got the helicopter back and everything. And it's so high up, you can almost see the curvature of the Earth at one point.
Oh, my God.
It's ridiculous. we're out in the middle of the savannah, so, I mean, it wasn't actually probably the curvature of the Earth, but it's ridiculously high.
Yeah.
Anyway, and what happened eventually is I had to turn the radio off. The helicopter went into a hover, and we literally had to wait for the batteries to die.
Wow.
So we just sat there and watched the helicopter and eventually just drop out the sky and tumble down and hit the deck. Luckily it was over a relatively soft bit of ground and the BBC's very, very expensive lens survived.
Oh, cool.
And I actually spent the next few days trying to rebuild the helicopter.
Wow.
But it wasn't successful enough to be able to use it for any of the rest of the few days I was there, unfortunately. But yeah, it was one of those, you know, very big learning experiences of this equipment not being 100% or even close to 100% reliable.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons that drove us very quickly after that towards looking at other potential technology, which is when we started to look at the very early stage multi-rotor technology at the time.
Yeah, okay. So what when would that have been? Couple of years later, or
when the probably first... looking at about 2013, 2014.
Okay. It's amazing, actually, isn't it, how quickly, you know, as you say, well, if the early drones came out then, that's just a couple, just sort of three, 4 years ago. Well, I suppose, hang on, no, it's 2000, yeah. five or 6 years ago. But,
6 years ago, yeah,
you know, now they're normal, aren't they? Everyone knows what they are.
Well, I think a lot of people, if not most people, have heard of DJI. Mm-hmm. They're the company that make pretty much, I think they have about a 70% market share over mm-hmm. all drone systems across the world. Everyone, if anyone's seen a drone, they've seen the DJI White Phantom drone, mm-hmm. Which is that small quadcopter. And DJI actually started probably only about a year before us.
Okay.
And the second model of the helicopter we used actually had DJI's first ever flight controller in it, called the XB3.1.
Okay.
And DJI are probably responsible for this massively quick development of all this drone technology and that kind of thing.
Mm.
So it's been interesting to see them go from back then, I think they had 4 employees, and in such a sort of space of time, grown into this huge multinational company that sells, you know, millions of drones all over the place.
Mm, incredible. And the BBC, obviously, you can't have done too bad a job because they did get you back to the various other programmes as well.
Yeah, over the years, we've done a few jobs here for the BBC, mm-hmm. Mostly in the UK, I must say. I don't know if there's a reason for that. And
no more lions.
No, we were certainly lucky enough to do some very exciting projects with the BBC and ITV and other TV producers as well. So it was we had a really good few years doing a lot of really fun stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So what prompted your decision to move back to the farm and look to setting up a business with your brother?
There's two things. One is it was kind of coming to the time where I was starting to have a young family,
mm-hmm.
and wanted to stop traveling quite so much.
Yeah.
But the other side of it was, I think it comes back to the speed that this technology, the drone technology, progressed at, meant that, you know, in 2015, 2016, a lot of cameramen that, you know, already provided all the other general camera services could go and buy a drone themselves, mm-hmm. learn how to fly it relatively easily, and it could provide them with the kind of quality of footage we were getting ourselves anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it started to become much more of an in-house tool rather than the kind of thing you'd employ a separate company to come and do.
Okay.
That meant there was starting to be a decline in the amount of business we saw. And at that stage, there was two ways to go. One was to really, really specialize in special types of filming with very, very advanced, expensive kit,
mm-hmm.
or look at a different direction. And my brother was just coming back from working for McLaren over in Spain for a while, and he was planning to come back to the farm. So we decided to start looking at how we could use drones in a farming environment.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's where Drone AG was born, and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, the great advantage we have had is that because we've got our own family farm here, we've been able to test and trial a lot of things in it directly in a working environment and learn from that.
Yeah. Yes. And I suppose Northumberland, with its big wide open spaces, is kind of the perfect place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And so no lines are actually smoothing.
Okay, so before we go any further then, I want to ask you a few questions about drones generally and their use in farming for people who might not be too familiar with them. So if you wanted to buy a drone just to use on the farm, for whatever reason, what kind of money are they?
Sure. So they're not particularly expensive anymore. In terms of a brand new drone, you'd be looking probably around about the £700-800 mark for a good one that's going to do everything you kind of want it to do to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a great secondhand market for these kind of systems as well. So if you're willing to get something that has been used before, that price point drops down to £400-500.
Wow. So in comparison with the other kind of kit you're buying for the farm, it's very, very little then, really.
Yeah. I think that, it's a very low cost entry into getting the hardware to start to be able to do things.
Mm.
I think there's, 2 years ago, it would have been a different story.
Mm-hmm.
But the technology really has moved that quickly. So.
Mm. Okay. Now, are they simple to use? Because I'm going to guess that some people might, if they're maybe not too tech savvy, they maybe think, well, you know, they may be kind of a bit daunted by them. But from when I saw you flying them in the field the other month, they're very easy to use, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, there's two ways to use them. One is to fly them manually using a controller, and the other way is to give them a task to do automatically, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And the manual flying, I mean, in the training we do, it takes, we get most people flying competently within an hour to 2 hours,
yeah.
I.e. being able to move the drone in the sky where they want it to be and take a photo or whatever and that uh-huh. kind of thing. And then obviously on the automated side of things, it's less about knowing how to actually fly the drone and more about knowing what software to use to tell it what you want it to do.
Hmm. Okay. And what about weather conditions? Is there any, I live in Northeast Wales, the weather's usually crap. What kind of weather conditions can you fly in?
So there are limits on that. It's not the kind of thing you're going to be able to use 365 days a year. Mm-hmm. Generally, I think the manufacturer specs for most drones say you can't fly in winds over about 24 miles an hour.
Okay.
Although we have had hours in wind pushing 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
What we generally find is that actually the drone just moves way too slowly if it's really windy, rather than getting knocked out of the sky or something. So it's not too dangerous to really to push it that in that way.
Hmm.
The other thing is obviously rain. Again, these systems aren't technically waterproof unless you get quite an expensive system.
Uh-huh.
So you generally don't want to be flying when it's raining and things like that. However, if you were caught in a rain shower or something, it's not going to destroy the drone. You'd be able to land the drone and dry it off and it wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah. Okay. And what about battery life? How long do the batteries last?
It's around about 25 minutes or so, 20 mm-hmm. to 30 minutes. Again, it depends on temperature and things like that. Obviously, colder weather means batteries don't last quite as long.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if it's flying in winds again, it's generally working a bit harder, so you might get a little bit less flight time. But it's mm-hmm. around 20 to 25 minutes sensibly.
Okay.
Manufacturers generally state about 30 minutes, but I think that's in lab perfect conditions and not real world, really.
Okay.
But generally, it's we find 20, 25 minutes will happily map or cover one or even two fields. And then it's very easy and very quick to change batteries and charge them and things like that.
Okay. I guess the way that battery technology is rapidly advancing, that will soon become a lot longer flight time anyway.
I'm not sure about that, to be honest.
Okay.
We've had this kind of battery technology for a good few years now.
Okay.
I think the way the batteries are managed has improved. And I think you're right. At some point, there will be a huge leap forward in battery technology.
Okay.
There's certainly a lot of development around that for obviously electric cars and things. But I would say new battery technology is a good few years away from coming into electric cars.
Okay.
And it'll be probably a couple of years after that before it trickles down to drones and things like that.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, within 5 years, I think we'll probably, we'll see drones that are either using fuel cell or something like lithium sulfur technology, which will mean they're having hours of flight time rather than minutes.
Okay. So could you sort of briefly talk us through a full growing season, say a wheat crop, and what you'd use the drone for at various stages of the crop?
Sure, no worries. So on our own farm here, what we find is that we're using them right at the beginning of the season. And actually what we're using them then for is generally two things. One is, if we go down the lines of a stale seed bed,
mm-hmm.
We let the weeds come through, and then we'll map those weed patches and then obviously kill them off and plant. And we can use those kind of maps to monitor where we might have potential weed problems throughout the rest of the season. So it's a tool to help us, keep an eye on those patches and that kind of thing, essentially. The other thing we're doing is we're mapping establishment. So once the crop does start to come through, we map to see where it's obviously coming through stronger and where it's coming through less, not quite so strong.
Mm-hmm.
For that, up here on our own farm, we do varial rate seeding based on soil type. But what we're planning to do next, from next season onwards, is actually use the drone establishment maps from the previous season to feed into those variorate seeding maps as well.
Okay.
Because we find the soil by itself, actually, while it does improve things, it doesn't. There's definitely room for improvement, and we think those establishment maps could really help with that.
Okay.
That's kind of the two things early season. Then as you go forward from there, there's not generally that much happening in winter.
No.
As we know, things kind of slow down. Yeah. Obviously, also, it happens to be the time when you don't really want to be outside if you can avoid it. Unless it's beautiful snow, and then, of course, it's a different story.
Yeah.
So we then look towards springtime pretty much. And in springtime, what we're doing is starting to monitor the crops on a more weekly basis. So it's the kind of time when you start field walking, when you start checking your field, seeing what's going on. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we'd be either mapping the fields to look at any kind of variability. And if we see some variability that we don't quite know what it is, it would be a way of guiding us into that field to have a look at what the potential problem is. We also, with our new software, can start to look at scouting those fields with a drone rather than walking. So getting into those points and seeing, okay, is there a weed here? Is there a disease? Is it just low green area index and low biomass and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
And then a bit further on, for things like oilseed rape, looking at variable-rate nitrogen, obviously there we're mapping and scouting for green area index and biomass and using that to feed into our variable-rate spreader, which is going to put on nitrogen only where it's needed. And obviously put on more nitrogen where it's needed more and less nitrogen where it's needed less. Idea of that being much more even crop and hopefully saving on nitrogen as well.
Mm. Okay.
It's also that kind of time of year is what we're starting to do now is there are a few different companies that are bringing out pretty good disease risk analysis. So companies, they can give you an idea of when disease risk is high for a certain type of crop at a certain type of year after certain weather conditions. So if we start to see the disease risk going up for a potential crop, then what we can do is we can map and start to just keep an eye on that field and see if there's any disease problems popping up and that kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, very, very, very versatile then. It's not just they're not just for playing around in. This is serious kit then, isn't it?
Yeah, they are. It's about knowing what you can do with them and how to use them and when is the key. They're certainly not something, I think, a few years ago, what people were thinking of is these drones mapping your whole entire farm every mm-hmm. couple of days and telling you if there was what the problems were and where they were and all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And so far, and there was visions, the farmer agronomist sitting in the office as the drone went and covered the whole farm for them, which was just not really possible and still isn't possible to a certain extent. But if you use them for specific tasks as tools for, specific things every now and again, they can be very powerful.
Yeah.
But we've also found with the mapping side of things, is that they have other benefits outside of crop mapping, like looking at, you can do measurements. So you can measure fields and look at where your margins are for RPA payments and that kind of thing. Even going towards farm building planning and things like that, you can map areas, see if areas are large enough for farm buildings. You can look at the roofs of farm buildings, see what condition they're in, all that kind of stuff as well. So there are, savings to be had through that. The farmer can do that himself with a drone rather than pulling someone else to. They're going to see savings in money and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, and one of the things I was super impressed with, as you know, when I saw you flying the drone was how quickly the maps came up on the tablet. I mean, it was a really quick turnaround, wasn't it? The drone flew up and down the field, and it seemed like within a couple of minutes, the map was on the field of the crop, showing where was good establishment, where was slightly less good establishment. And it was really, really quick turnaround.
Yeah. With the way the technology is now, we're moving away from the idea that you have to get all this data, then upload it to the internet to get processed overnight, or you rely on an internet connection or have a really powerful computer that needs to process all the data. So the live mapping technology is much better. As you saw, it pretty much is processing that map as the drone flies. So by the time you've landed, you have the map there. It should be said that map, all it's telling you is where there's differences in the field. So it'll highlight, like you said, where there's more growth and where there's less growth, potentially highlight where there's different coloration, which might be due to it being a weed rather than crop, or the crop being unhealthy and that kind of thing. But it can't really tell you what the problem is. It can only tell you where there is a potential issue and that kind of thing. And it is quite an involved process as well still. This is one of the things we found, is that if you know what you're doing and you're willing to take the time to do some training and then, you know, invest in the time needed to learn how to do all this mapping, it can certainly there are great benefits for it. But we also understand that a lot of farmers and agronomists don't have that much time available to them. And sometimes the kind of whole mapping technology can be a little bit long-winded. And that's why we've been developing the Skippy Scout side of things, to use a drone for scouting instead of mapping.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, that's a perfect segue into Skippy Scout, because it is exciting times there right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really exciting. Skippy Scout's been one of those things that it's been in the back of my mind for a good few years now. Mm-hmm. How can we make all of this simpler and that kind of thing? Because we always thought there'd be a way to do it. And we started looking at it a few years ago, but it was only really last year when we came up with the idea of Skippy Scout and thinking, right, okay, what if we just use a drone to kind of augment and help field walking rather than trying to map a whole field? Mm-hmm. And the added benefit of using a drone just for scouting is that it's providing useful data, but it's data that the farmer or agronomist already understands. It's already what they get in the field when they field walk. The drone will just collect that data for them a lot, lot faster. But they understand the data in the way that they can use it within their current workflows now, rather than having to learn how to use a load more data in a completely new way.
So
I think that's one of the reasons we find that agronomists and farmers are really getting this new technology and understanding it, is because they already understand the outputs it gives.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, one of the simple ideas behind this is all you need is a drone and a smartphone.
Yeah, I mean, it literally is that. Yeah. That's any features we've been building for this. The first thing we've thought is, okay, you must only need a phone and a drone to do it. Mm. And two, it must be simple enough to do that you don't need any training either. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of been the two things. And yeah, I mean, literally, you just need your phone and the drone. Everything's done via the app on the phone. And as we bring in the AI analysis side of things as well, that will all happen on the phone as well. So there'll be no need to use a computer or anything like that, just the smartphone.
Okay. So if I rang you and said, right, Skippy sounds fantastic, I want you to come down and set me up with this on my farm, what are the first things that you would do, apart from like assessing whether I was competent enough to do it, and that's questionable, but what would you be looking at on my farm? All the typical farm growing cereal crops, for example.
Okay, so in crop walking time of year, like time of year it is now, basically, we'd be saying to, you know, the farmer, okay, when you go out crop walking normally, what are you going to look at and where are you going to look at it? Farm might give us idea, say they're doing a standard W in a field. In some fields, they might be going to look at very specific spots where they know they've had issues in the past, or looking at spots where, you know, the sprayer driver might have said, I've spotted a bad patch of oats popping up here and that kind of thing. So we'd say, okay, when we get to the field's edge, instead of walking to those points, what we'll do is we'll essentially bring up the app, connect it to the drone, and we'll assign those points on the app instead. Hit go, and off the drone will go. It'll fly to each of those points. It'll send to about a couple of meters to a meter above the crop, take a photo, and it'll do those at each of the points. And it, you know, the drone can fly a lot faster than you can walking. So the drone is covering a lot more land than you could in the time you could walk. With agronomists, what we actually find is that they might be actually walking to a couple of points in the field anyway, and the drone is filling in a load more points for them to give them a lot more detail. Either way, once the drone's finished, when it's on its way back, it'll sync all the photos up with the phone. So before the drone's landed, the farmer will have all the photos from those points on his phone. He'll be able to zoom into them, have a look, see if he can spot the issues he might have been worried about, or, you know, potentially he'll spot issues that he didn't know about. At the moment, the way it works is they have those photos there and then they can share them wherever they want. So he might want to sync them up with his farm planning software, or he might want to send him to an agronomist to say, okay, there's a weed in this image. I don't know what kind of weed it is. Can you let me know? And let me know if I need to spray it and that kind of thing. And then very soon, the next phase essentially is we're going to integrate the AI we've been developing into the app. So it will automatically give them measurements of green area index. It'll show if there's any weeds present or any disease present in the image and flag that up for them as well.
Wow. So how long would it take to say, for example, a 50 acre field, how long would it take to cover that?
50 acres is around about 20 hectares, just under.
Yeah. Yes.
That's my terrible maths coming to play there. Probably 2 to 3 minutes.
Wow.
It depends very much on the amount of points you're putting into the field.
Yeah.
We generally work on about 2 points per hectare. Mm-hmm. And at that, you know, we're scouting around about a hectare a minute. Mm-hmm. But you can obviously put a load more points into that field if you want to get a lot more detail in that field. Mm-hmm. Again, it depends on the time of year. You know, some of the agronomists we work with have said at the beginning of the year they might be scouting fields quite thoroughly, but towards the end of the spring season, they might just be literally double checking a couple of points per field, in which case they can just send the drone out really quickly and to get those 2 points and off they go. The way we've calculated it, it's around about at least 5 times faster than it would be on foot, which means it's 5 times faster for farmers. So they're going to cover 5 times more land in the same amount of time.
Yeah.
For agronomists, 5 times faster equates to around about a 2 times overall productivity gain.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah, that's super impressive. You're right at the launch phase here, but where do you see this going? I mean, as the technology improves, what does the future hold sort of 5 years down the line?
We are at the launch phase. We've got the initial version up and running. We've actually, it's exploded over the last 2 months. We've got about 200 users all signed up and testing it now. Mm-hmm. And they're all over the world as well. We weren't expecting to get interest from other parts of the world quite so soon, but we have had. So it's great to have a few people testing it in different countries. We're getting feedback from all those people now. We certainly have a big plan in mind for the next few years in terms of what features we want to add. Mm-hmm. And that feedback will help to guide which way we go with it. But we know that what we want to add in first and foremost is to get the AI fully integrated and start training that AI to be able to recognize different types of diseases and things in a lot of different crops. And we also will bring the live mapping side of things directly into the app, so that we can start to very quickly live map fields and use that information to guide where the drone scouts. It'll start to go towards much more automation in that way. If the drone's deciding where it needs to scout in the field automatically, it takes another decision away from the user and just makes things more autonomous and hopefully much more efficient again.
Yeah.
Further down the line, we have huge plans. We're keeping quite a lot of them under wraps because we think some of them are quite novel ideas. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to give away too much. But we're certainly, the way we're going with this is looking at how drone systems can, one, become more automated themselves, but how they can also start to control other types of automated machinery more directly.
Wow. Jeez, it's such an exciting time. I'm going to sound like a sort of really excited 8-year-old lad now, but it's such an exciting time to be in farming, isn't it? You really do wonder where it's going to all be in 20 years' time. That's absolutely awesome.
I think a couple of years ago when everyone was talking about robots driving around fields and drones flying around in the air, everyone was a bit like, yeah, it'll happen at some point in the future. Yeah. Before it's actually happening now, which is quite exciting.
Exactly. Yeah. So, how long, I guess, I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but how far away are we from drones being able to fly themselves? You being able to not go out of the farm office and the drone be able to go out and scout the field without you having to stand at the edge of the field and watch it?
Well, I would say the technology is there already. You can do it now.
Right. Okay.
It's more at the moment a legislation holdup.
Okay.
I think holdup's actually probably the wrong word because although the technology is there to allow the drones to do this, the technology isn't quite there yet for the drones to be able to sense other aircraft in the airspace.
Okay.
Right, so what that basically means, what that means is if they were flying around by themselves without a pilot watching them and there was another aircraft in the sky, the drone potentially wouldn't avoid that aircraft and we'd get into an accident.
Right.
Okay. So we need the what we call the sense and avoid side of things to improve, one. That technology has definitely been developed and a few different drone systems have them already. Generally, they're very expensive at the moment, but that price point will come down. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we'll see the legislation start to catch up. And I think, farmland, big wide open spaces in the middle of nowhere is the perfect place to start using what we call beyond visual line of sight technology and start to allow these drones to fly much further by themselves. So as we start to bring that in, that's when they will definitely start to become a lot more autonomous and be doing things a lot more by themselves.
Cheers. That is awesome. All right. So you are launching a crowdfunding campaign with this. Tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, off the back of the successful launch last year of the trial software of Skippy Scout. Mm-hmm. We are looking for funding to help us develop the next phase as nice and as quickly as possible, really.
Yeah.
We really want to get moving. So we were looking at funding options towards the end of last year, deciding which way to go. We certainly could have gone down the private funding route, looking at angels and things like that. And they still certainly form a key part of our plan. But we also wanted to involve the farming community. A lot of what we've done is based on feedback from the farming community already, not just on our own farm but from across the country. So it really made sense to us to get them involved in the investment side of things as well as just the feedback side of things. And obviously crowdfunding is a great way to do that. So we're launching a crowdfunding campaign. It's in private mode at the moment. It'll go public within a few weeks. And that is to raise £250,000 to start to develop the next phase of Skippy Scout, aiming to obviously, like I said, integrate the AI side of things, live mapping, and to get it commercially launched next year.
Wow. Wow. So when do you set that open? A couple of weeks time?
It'll go public in a couple of weeks. But we're in private mode at the moment. We already have a bid in and we're talking to a few private investors and that kind of thing at the moment.
Okay. So where can people find out more information?
You can go into our website. So that's droneag.farm /invest. There's a link on the website as well. If you just go straight there, you can also email me directly. That's jack@droneag.farm as well. I am trying to reply to everything myself, but it is getting a bit crazy. So bear with me if you do email me directly.
Yeah. Okay. So, for people who might be interested in and want to invest in this, what benefits are there for people sort of getting in early?
So, there's a few benefits, I would say, but one of the big ones is on the tax benefit side of things, actually. We can offer, we're eligible for something called SEIS, which is a government tax-based scheme, which essentially gives any investors 50% of their investment back in tax relief. If someone invested, say, £1,000, they will get £500 back in tax relief. But that SEIS pot is only for the first £150,000.
Okay.
Some of it's already gone through private investment, but that's the kind of thing that will go quite quickly, I think. The other benefits are that we can offer certain bonuses and that kind of thing. And it's great to just have as many people on board as fast as possible, really.
Absolutely. And you will be demonstrating at the Harper Adams Drone Conference, I believe, next month?
That's right, yeah. The Harper Adams Drone Conference, I can't remember the date of that, actually.
Is it April?
It's April the 9th.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll be at the Harper Adams Drone Conference. I'll be doing a talk there. Mm-hmm. We'll also be doing a drone demo alongside the Harper guys as well with drone spraying and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that should be a really, really good day and a really good place to find out more about what we're doing, but also about what other people are doing in the drone world as well in terms of agriculture and the wider rural environment and that kind of thing.
Definitely.
I'm looking forward to that. It'll be a good day.
Definitely.
That should be towards the end of our funding campaign as well. So hopefully we'll have good news by that point.
Exciting. So one more thing before we start to wrap this up. Jack, I'm a child of the 1980s and I grew up loving the Back to the Future movies. We talked all about drones tonight. When are we getting the hoverboards? That's what I want to know.
Have you seen, anyone who's listening, you can Google it. I'm sure you'll find it. But there's a Canadian mad inventor who has built a hoverboard.
No way. Is that right?
He holds the world record for crossing, I think it's a big lake on a hoverboard.
Oh, wow.
And it's got like 20 drone motors underneath it. And he stands on it and he's just blasting across over the place. It looks scary and dangerous, but it's there working. So kind of already there with that kind of thing.
I thought they'd be mainstream by now. Very disappointing. Right, okay. So, as you know, let's wrap these up with the 5 hard-hitting questions. So if you're ready, we'll give these a go. Sure. What is your all-time favourite song, Jack?
It does vary a lot depending on the mood I'm in, but probably the one I listen to most is Back in Black, AC/DC.
Oh, tune. Absolute tune. Okay, if you took your drone technology and took it a step or two further and managed to invent a time machine, where's the first place you'd go?
I think a lot of people say the future, but actually I'd probably go right back to the dawn of the universe and find out how it actually happened, because I'd love to know. I think everyone would.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I was expecting you to say the future just because of everything you're on the cusp of there, but that's a really good answer. Okay.
That would be the second place, I think.
What movie can you watch over and over again and not get bored of?
Well, I'm a geek at heart, so pretty much any of the Marvel movies I'll happily see again and again and again. They're just, you know, ultimate escapism and easy watching. So yeah, that's kind of my go-to place.
Yeah, which is your favourite, if push came to shove, for your Marvel movies?
Ooh, probably the first Iron Man, actually.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one. Good choice. Okay, how long would you last for in a zombie apocalypse?
I would like to think a while. I mean, farmer, so got a shotgun. Yeah. So probably quite a good start, you know, living in the countryside.
You're in
as
a good place for it up in Northumberland as
good
well.
Good place for it. Yeah, we're pretty far away from everything. Yeah. So if it did happen, we'd probably have a bit of forewarning.
Yeah.
It might not be too long before the old Border Reavers fight starts to kick off and we have the problem with some Scots. So.
Yeah. Okay. And lastly, then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media, who would it be and why?
AG Robot John, Jonathan Gill on Twitter. Jonathan Gill is one of the lead guys behind the Hands-Free Hector and Harp Adams.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. He's really hot on stuff. He always posts lots of really interesting, quirky things.
Definitely, yeah.
To do with agriculture and robotics and stuff like that. So, yeah, that would be my recommendation.
Okay. Jack, it's been fantastic to speak to you. It's so exciting to hear about what you're doing there. And it's, I'm actually quite excited for you for the next few years because it's such a big, I think it's going to be massive for you.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It's really, really exciting. And here's to that.
Yeah, best of luck with everything going forward.
Thanks, Will. Cheers.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. And I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.